So as I say, what I've put together is basically some response to the program for this panel and also the reading brochure, which includes essays and roundtables on aspects of contemporary criticism. The panel description lists three factors to consider about the demise of judgment in contemporary art criticism. The first is the proliferation of art styles in the closing decades of the 20th century. The second is the recently inflated art market. Maybe that's the recently deflated art market. Three is the legacy of institutional critique. And what I want to do is provide some comments on these three factors with reference to the text presented in the brochure. But first, I want to cite a particular piece of writing, which for me has implications for the whole matter of judgment and art. It should be familiar to a lot of you, as it comes from Hegel's Lectures on Aesthetics, last delivered in 1828, and I will add that this is probably the only piece of Hegel that I can really feel confident in talking about. Art, considered in its highest vocation, is and remains for us a thing of the past. Thereby, it has lost for us genuine truth in life and has rather been transferred to our ideas instead of maintaining its earlier necessity in reality and occupying its higher place. What is now aroused in us by works of art is not just immediate enjoyment, but our judgment also, since we subject to our intellectual consideration, one, the content of art, and two, the work of art's means of presentation and the appropriateness and inappropriateness of both to one another. Now, why I raise this is, I mean, on one hand, we could sit there and say that there's this massive Winckelmann-like fantasy behind that of, you know, sort of the Greek city-state where, you know, nice polychrome statues were like alive people and this kind of stuff, or the equally erroneous fantasy of the Gothic cathedral as the Bibles of the poor. We can see it going down through Romanticism. And what I'm trying to say is that I think this idea of the past being the dominant mode of our ideas about art, or the idea that we're somehow separated from art, I think that that continues down to today, whether it's through the spontaneity of abstract expressionism or some of the immediacies around conceptual art, or right down to the ideas of community being followed in things like relational aesthetics. So I think that this is important, this idea of separation and the idea that there is somehow a way in which judgment is a way of compensating for that lack of immediate connection with the work of art that we dream of. And again, I want to make it clear, I don't believe in it. I think it's a fantasy, but it may be one that we can't do without. Now, with that, of course, the way that I came to that passage from Hegel is actually through Arthur Danto's After the End of Art. So I'm going to talk about that. The idea of the proliferation of art styles in the closing decades of the 20th century having impact on judgment can fairly easily be associated with the end of art thesis propounded by critic and philosopher Arthur Danto. In The End of Art from 1997, he discusses what he calls a democracy of pluralism, whereby, quote, there is now no special way a work of art must be, end of quote, tracing this back to Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes of 1964, which possess no distinguishing visual difference from the Brillo boxes in the supermarket. While Danto has much more to say on that example, his point is that the Warhols signal the end of that notion of the special way art must be, which he attributes to what he calls the Age of Manifestos, broadly consistent with the period of post-Hegelian modern art, and culminating with the rise of the avant-garde and the neo-avant-garde, the Age of Manifestos is marked by practices of inclusion and exclusion, which dictate that certain types of artwork exemplify the most significant art and that all other contemporary art is inferior, perhaps not art at all. The declaration of inclusion and exclusion is an exceptional type of judgment, in action where discrimination takes first place. One of the most often discussed example of this is Michael Fried's 1967 Art and Objecthood, not least discussed mostly by himself, where the medium specificity of modernist painting and sculpture and the theatricality of minimal art are said to be at war with one another. And implicitly, Fried downgrades minimal art to near non-art status. And I should mention in the booklet here how Christopher Bedford seems to want to call back to this type of exclusionary judgment, but without the entailment of media specificity, which sort of makes it, I think, a kind of erroneous thing to claim. Meanwhile, in her Changing Inconsistency, also from 1967, Lucie Lepard is already preparing ground for moving away from the exclusionary mode when she argues that, quote, a judgment on contemporary art is tentatively true, like the scientist law and unlike a legal law. And here, of course, we run into the kind of experimentalism that we find in the 60s and also moving towards ideas of maybe of provability, falsibility, falsifiability, and so on in science, maybe even an echo of Thomas Kuhn's ideas of paradigm shift. She goes on to say that, quote, the critic's role is descriptive rather than prescriptive, end of quote, and seems to be anticipating her own subsequent practice as a critic of the conceptual art that most clearly tried to avoid or render useless the categories of painting and sculpture which upheld exclusionary judgment for free. And so we should also think of Lepard's later commitments to feminist art and to issues of identity and locale, which I think all proceed from this rejection of this exclusionary judgment. We can see the legacy of this move from prescriptive judgment to tentative description also operating in the October Roundtable on Art Criticism, when David Joslett speaks of judging what constitutes an object of history, an object of aesthetic interpretation, or when he speaks of judging the boundaries of a field in the context of engaging both art, both contemporary art and visual culture. In this move, I think we need to come closer to considering not the proliferation of styles, but rather the proliferation of objects and the proliferation of aspects in the field of contemporary art. For Sven Lüdeken, the issue pivots on the distinction Joseph Kossuth is credited with elaborating between specific and generic art, whereby painting would be a specific type of art, whereas conceptual art would be a general or generic type of art. With generic art or art in general being a situation where, quote from Lüdeken, objects nowadays exhibited in art no longer derive their legitimacy from a tradition or an artistic medium, but from the very fact that their artistic status is initially dubious. That's the end of quote, and that obviously we can think of the shadow or the cast by the ready-made over this entire field. All art is conceptual after Duchamp, as Kossuth claims. Such a proliferation of objects for contemporary art has a consequence that, for Lüdeken, differently politicizes the sort of pluralism Dante cheers on as democratic. Since art can include most anything, it then is open to a new way to the commodity relations of spectacular society. So the artist has become an exemplary consumer. Meanwhile, the sort of criticism which tries to stress art's potential for dissent and difference risks being merely what Lüdeken calls the marketing slogans for art that has sabotaged such a project. In response to this potential sabotage, Lüdeken, with a nod to Boris Groys, discusses Marcel Breuders as an artist whose consuming, quote, is not merely a reflection of the spectacle, but a reflection on it. And he further claims that this sort of meta-consumption can result in, quote, decoding deviant commodities, which are more thought-provoking and productive compounds of the irrational rationality of the spectacle, unquote. Though he appears to laud this tendency and to link it to other scripto-visual artists like Dan Graham and Robert Smithson, Lüdeken is also concerned with the way in which what he calls the ideology of art dictates that the culture industry represents the big bad cop, while the art business is the good cop, is, he says, good for people, refined, complex, and critical. Aware that critical writing, whether or not it's judgmental, is part and parcel of art's privileged position as something somehow regarded as not entirely instrumentalized, Lüdeken writes of the uninflected importation of contemporary cultural theory into artistic and cultural discourse as often constituting unreflective consumption, which he calls, quote, a pathetic, pathological tangle of slogans and hype, end of quote. And I'm also thinking here about Julian Stalabras's work on in Art Incorporated about the idea of art being somehow representative of freedom, but also being the kind of hard-won freedom valued in millions of dollars. Now we are quite clearly near to the question of the recently inflated market and its impact on judgment. Is this really a problem? Everyone notes, with Lüdeken and James Elkins, the imperative that art must appear with some sort of writing attached to it. And equally, they note that there has recently been more publishing of commentary, gossip, blogging, publicity, and art writing than possibly ever before. In addition, Elkins, following Boris Groys as well, claims that most of what is produced is nothing and certainly not worthy of close reading. And Elkins even wants us to include press releases and gallery blurbs as part of what we consider art criticism without really justifying why he would take that. But he's more interested, it seems, in taxonomy than actually judgment. Meanwhile, Tim Griffin, editor of Art Forum, claimed in its market discussions last year that the abundance of advertising in his magazine led him away from the market to areas where he could use the ad revenue to pursue other ends. And this, of course, justifying his inclusion of special features on people like the philosopher Jacques Rancière, the dancer Michael Clarke, or the novelist, the memoirs or tributes to the novelist Alain Robbe-Grillet. In this example, the judgment of an object of history, which Joselyt upheld, sustains what Hal Foster refers to as the archaeological function of criticism, returning the forgotten or revaluing the marginal thanks to revenue from a market whose interest it nominally does not represent. Though here, we must recall the review that reviving marginal figures extends the stock available for dealing. I am no Dave Hickey apologist for the market, but diffidence about the art market's relationship to questions of criticism and judgment does not necessitate either an embrace nor a divorce from ubiquitous market pressures. Rather, we can look to the art market's many contradictory aspects, the lack of a clear sense of what art is worth, what it can do, how it is promoted simultaneously as a token of freedom and as a possessable object, as luxury goods and as cultural patrimony. These questions are grounded in matters of autonomy and heteronomy, the two poles which, according to Pierre Bourdieu, structure the field of cultural production, making its 19th century French formation that he studied what he called the economic world reversed. Now, the field of contemporary art in the recent past might be spoken of as the economic world synchronized. What I'm trying to get at is not that the market dictates criticism. Tim Griffin, again, wonders if a poor review would have had any consequences these days, but that inflation of a bubble market, and especially the corrosive effects of market relations as the dominant mode of social life, resulting in the removal of publicness and the encouragement of weak citizenship, has taken on the character of a neoliberal monolith. And here I might refer you to Holland Cotter's short article in the New York Times from the 15th of February called "The Boom is Over, Long Live the Art," where he sort of dreams that if the bubble is gone, we can return to serious business again. I'm not sure if I'm so hopeful. Here we might turn away from the art market towards the questions of funding and governance of public institutions like museums. As Andrea Fraser points out in the October discussion, the privatization and corporatization of museums and galleries is a result of a historical shift since the 70s, where, as she describes, aggressive ambition of building audience for art museums, whereby museums began to recognize that they had publics and public responsibilities, as did artists and critics, came to be seen through the prism of professional and institutional needs. So art for art's sake was replaced by growth for art's sake, which is often seen a thin cover for growth's sake, end of quote. This is somewhat related to an argument brought forth by Benjamin Buchlow concerning how one target of conceptual art's thorough criticism of the field of contemporary art in the 60s and 70s was, quote, the secondary discursive text that attached itself to artistic practice, end of quote. Further, he claims, readers' competence and spectatorial competence had reached a level where the meddling of the critic was historically defied and denounced. So critics made, so we have a kind of version of the death of the author here, where the death of the author is the birth of the reader. But the idea that this, linking this to the potentially liberatory politics of some claims for conceptual art, I thought was relatively unique for him to bring up in this case. What interests me here is this trend to revise the relatively recent past, to see that forms of democratization and decentralization, to use the progressive bureaucratic language of the time, to see how these laudable aims pointed away, again, from exclusive judgment, need to be understood at plays in a field where every part is active and unforeseen consequences need to be brought to light and accounted for. This brings me to the legacy of institutional critique, inasmuch as Buchlow is credited with its initial theorization, and Andrea Fraser is surely one of its most articulate practitioners. Indeed, in the reading brochure, as far as I can tell, only Fraser offers the definition of criticism. She writes, or says, "I define criticism as an ethical practice of self-reflective evaluation of the ways in which we participate in the reproduction of relations of domination, which include for me the exploitation of competence and other forms of institutional authority. This definition also leads her, in direct response to art criticism, to recommend a specific, a site-specific type of art criticism. That means, she says, not misrecognizing your readership as the other of your discourse, but as the actual people who are probably going to be picking up the magazine and looking through its pages. Sven Lüdeken comes to a similar conclusion when he writes of the possibility that the ideology of art, the idea that art is good, that leads to that good cop, bad cop scenario, also permits what he deems fragile alliances between institutions and individuals in the art world. This, to me, is a large part of the legacy of institutional critique, because Lüdeken and Fraser not only recognize the importance of critique and contextualization, but they also display an abiding investment in the institutions they subject to critique. Such has always marked the strongest manifestations of the critique of institutions, such as the conviction that Hans Hacke held that his real-time social system, Schapolsky et al., could be shown at the Guggenheim Museum because officials would recognize its public importance. Of course, they did not. Director Thomas Messer performed the real critique by canceling the exhibition. Once again, and firing Edward Frey. Once again, the legacy of institutional critique prompts judgment of matters of exclusion and inclusion in cultural life and those relations of domination we all participate in by assuming that their description or redescription offers aims towards attempts to fulfill potentials latent and repressed within institutions. So I suppose I have covered the three points and proposed some approaches arising from them. One, if we move from regarding the proliferation of styles to the proliferation of objects or the proliferation of aspects in the field of contemporary art, I believe that we will realize that the true difference is that we no longer judge objects or works of art, but assess or analyze projects or practices. And this could be linked further back to something that Charles Harrison and Art and Language have spoken of as the forms of self-curation, so that artists don't make work anymore, they make exhibitions, they make shows. And of course, this goes back to, say, Carl Andre and Dan Flavin's post-studio practices, where they put together their shows in the gallery. They didn't even have a sort of separate place to work. So this idea we don't judge objects so much as projects. Two, the recently inflated market is an aspect, maybe an extremely dangerous aspect, of the relations of domination, whereby art and culture are part of the dominant portion of social life, as Bourdieu would have it. The feints and moves of that sector affect judgment not by dominating it, but by exciting all manner of play between autonomous and heteronomous positions and dispositions. This is not meant to be comforting to you, but it does offer, through critique and analysis, the possibility of plotting the players and comprehending their moves. Three, the legacy of institutional critique is best understood as an unrelenting ethical imperative to, as Fraser puts it in speaking of her own practice, quote, to perform the inseparability of freedom and determination, to perform that contradiction without distancing it in facile irony or collapsing it in cynicism. That's the end of quote. And I guess now, with the inseparability of freedom and determination, we're back with Hegel. So we come back to the quote from Hegel, and I want to note something which lingers in his writing, which could be more explicit in my description of the replacement of exclusive judgment with the judgments of objects of interpretation and of aspects of the field. And that is, namely, that art is not now operating in pursuit of its highest vocation, and it is the memory of that idea of the highest vocation and the idealism that is entailed which rules out exclusionary judgment. Thank you.